Please give Don a shtender, because today Rav Osa was starting a new Mishnah, and that's on Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, and we're going to start actually on Mem Beis Amud Beis, but we'll get to Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph right away.
We're getting to your topic.
Yeah, this is my topic. This is Muktzah. The only problem I have is that Muktzah sort of comes in a little bit here. This is a much more advanced halacha of Muktzah than the Mishnayos didn't organize it in such a way that there's an introduction to Muktzah. So we'll have to sort of offer the introduction as we go along. Ein nosnin kli tachas haner. Now, one of the classical cases of Muktzah in Masechet Shabbos is Shemen Shebener, which means that you're lighting on Erev Shabbos a candle for the purpose of Shalom Bayis, for the mitzvah of Hadlokas Ner Shabbos, and that shemen which you put into the Ner is the receptacle, was designated in a singular way for the mitzvah of Ner Shabbos. Now, oil in those days, and even today, is a very important commodity, and some of the oil would inevitably spill out of the nair, out of the receptacle. And the question is, are you allowed to at least put a utensil underneath the nair to receive the dripping of the oil so that you'll use it even after Shabbos? So in other words, you're not really moving Muktzah, you're not touching Muktzah, the oil is Muktzah, but you're not handling the Muktzah. But what you're doing is you're moving a kli, a utensil which is not Muktzah, for the sake of Muktzah.
On Shabbos, before Shabbos?
On Shabbos. So on Erev Shabbos, you designated this Ner, and you lit the candle, and it's burning away. This becomes a classical case of Muktzah. And shemen is muktzah, you're not allowed to move it, you're not allowed to use it for food, you can't have any benefit from it. That's called muktzah. Again, we're going to get into that. That's really the basics of muktzah, which is going to come up later on in Daf Mem Dalet. But what's going on in this particular Mishnah is, can I move object X, which is not muktzah, for the sake of object Y, which is muktzah? Meaning, I want to save this oil as it drips out of the nair. And I'm moving a kli to receive that oil. I'm going to use that oil after Shabbos, so I won't violate in any way the classical frontal Isur Muktzah. But on the other hand, I'm moving a receptacle for the sake of Muktzah. And you and I would say that that's perfectly permissible. I mean, you're not moving Muktzah, you're just trying to save... You're trying to save the oil that it doesn't, fall onto the floor and then it goes for naught. You know, it's completely destroyed, and you're not moving Muktzah. But the Mishnah says, that's what we're reading here on Daf Mem Beis Amud Beis. To our surprise, ein nosnin kli tachas haner. You're not allowed to move a receptacle, a bowl, let's call it, in order to place it underneath the candle in such a way that the oil that'll fall out of the nair will be caught by this kli, lekabel bos hashemen, to receive that oil. Now Rashi here is going to offer two explanations as to why you're not allowed to do this kind of thing. So if you look at Rashi, first of all, he says ein nosnin, he addresses your question, Joel, and he says bishabis. And then he says, kli tachas haner. Why? Why is he putting this kli underneath the nair? So Rashi says, lekabel bo, to receive in this utensil, shemen, the oil shemen hametaftif, that drips out of the candle. Now, why is this prohibited? So first of all, Rashi says, and he's going to give, as I said, two interpretations, but first Rashi lays down the basic principle that no one questions, that this is unquestionable, and that is mishum de shemen muktzahu. The shemen itself, the oil, is muktzah. Okay, now we want to know, okay, he's not moving the shemen. What is he moving?
The kli.
So that's not muktzah. What's the problem? Ukasavar, and this is Rashi's first interpretation. You'll see on the next line he has inami, a second interpretation. In his first interpretation, Kasavar, which literally translates, he is of the opinion, meaning the author of the Mishnah is of the opinion, Ein kli nitol b'Shabbos. You're not allowed to move a utensil on Shabbos. Ella, unless litzorech davar hanitol. Unless it's for the purpose of something that itself could be moved. And not for the sake of something that in itself is muktzah and cannot be moved. So this is what we have to memorize. These are the words that you might want to underline. Ein kli nital b'Shabbos el litzorech davar hanitol. Let's go over it one more time. You're only allowed to move a kli for the sake of something else that's a davar hanitol, that in itself is permissible to move. So for example, if I want to put my plate on the table, and what am I going to put in my plate? Food. The food is a davar hanitol, so I'm allowed to use my kelim in order to put food into it, because food is a davar hanitol. But now I'm moving a kli for on Shabbos for the purpose of receiving the shemen. The shemen itself is a davar she'eino nital. It's muktzah. And Rashi's first explanation is that you're only allowed to move a kli for the purpose of something that's nital, that you're allowed to move on Shabbos. And what we're basically seeing here, I call this the expansion rule of muktzah. What I mean is that muktzah is kind of like, you know, it's like throwing a stone in a pond, in a river, and it, you know, the ripples kind of go, you know, waves, and it gets, you know, muktzah is a very fascinating concept. We're not ready to get into this, but just by way of introduction, what's unique about muktzah is that it just grows and grows and grows. You know, it doesn't stop. I mean, you start with the classical case of muktzah. Maybe you want to make a note of this, and Don, I think this will help you a lot if you make a note of this. The classical case of muktzah is what's called etzim va'avonim, which literally translates as trees or branches, and stones. Now let's take the case of a stone. A stone is muktzah. Why is a stone muktzah? And the answer is because it's purposeless. What do I mean it's purposeless? I can decide that I want to use a stone for any number of things. I'm not talking about a precious stone, that's a jewel. But for example, if I need a doorstop, on a windy day, I can use a stone for a doorstop. But that means that I designated it as such. In the absence of designation, a stone unto itself is meaningless. It's worthless. What do I mean by worthless? It doesn't have a function. The key to understanding muktzah is the contrast between two categories. Category number one is something that has a function, and category number two is something that has no function whatsoever, as is. You can decide that you want to use it. You could decide that this is going to be, you know, this is going to be your doorstop. But up until that point, the status of the stone unto itself, until you designate it, is functionless, if we can call it that. That makes it muktzah by definition. And so too, if you walk on the street and you'll see branches that are on the ground, that's called eitzim, right? Pieces of wood. I'm not even talking about a wood that's growing, that's still attached to the ground, which you're not allowed to cut down on Shabbos. I'm even talking about wood that's laying around, it's been cut off. You know, somebody grabbed a branch and he dropped it on the street. Now you want to use that branch, you want to move that branch, you're not allowed to do so. That's classical muktzah. That's the most extreme paradigm of muktzah, because that's called eitzim vavonim. Another example would be afar. Afar would be the dirt on the roads, on the street. You know what I'm talking about? Afar, ayin pei resh. That would be another classical case of muktzah. And from that case, almost like a hub, you know, the spikes of the wheel just grow and grow and grow. We're gonna have a case of muktzah which fits onto food, but it's spoiled food. We might have muktzah in a case of a broken kli that has no function. Your classical case of non-muktzah would be a kli. A kli is something that has a function. You go into a store right here in Israel, in Yerushalayim, you have what's called clay bayit store. You know, anything you buy in that store, by definition, is not muktzah. Why? Because it's a kli. And there's an entire mesechta in Shas, not mesechta Shabbos, that's dedicated to the definition of a kli. What's that mesechta called? Exactly, mesechta Kelim. You guessed it. I think it's 22 chapters. It's one of those complicated, long, extensive studies to define what exactly is a kli. But for our simplistic purposes, a kli is anything that's designated for use. And therefore, since it's designated for use, it's not muktzah. Because muktzah means something that has no use. It's functionless. Now in this case, in our Mishnah, the shemen is established to be muktzah, and the reason for that definition of shemen as muktzah is not because it's functionless. You know, there are a lot of things that you can do. Here's a chair, which I'm not using. Okay.
Rabbi, are you going to want a chair for later to sit down?
No, I'm not. I'm not going to be sitting today. Okay. So shemen oil has a function. You know, you could use it for. You could use it for your salad. You could use it for many things. So why is shemen muktzah? And the answer to that is because of something called muktzah machmas isur, which means that if you were to take this shemen, you would be violating one of the 39 malachas of Shabbos. Which malacha? Mechaber. Kibud. Kibud means to extinguish. So if you would grab a piece, siphon off some of the oil from a candle, that would be a violation of kibud. So the shemen, therefore, is what's called muktzah machmas isur. So here we have a case of a category of muktzah which is not functionless, pardon the double negative, it does have a function. Certainly shemen can be used for any number of things. But since it was designated for isur, for something that's prohibited, because if you were to take the shemen, you would inadvertently violate the isur of mechaber. Therefore, it becomes muktzah machmas isur. Another classical case of muktzah machmas isur would be, in the Gemara's language, chatzotzros. Okay, that's a Gemara that we'll have a little later. Chatzotzros are musical instruments. In this case, a trumpet. But whatever your musical instrument is, because we don't do music on Shabbos. Even as much as we'd like to do music on Shabbos, it seems like the most natural thing, get a band to play on Shabbos, but we don't do that. And therefore, a musical instrument is also called muktzah machmas isur. Now, I'm giving you it very simplistically. What I just told you is a matter of tremendous controversy. Because there are many things that you could do with chatzotzros, with trumpets. And in fact, back in the day, sometimes if they didn't have a kli, like a funnel or something, they used to pour liquids into the opening of the mouth of the trumpet, and then it would come out slowly but surely through the part that goes to the lips. So that doesn't make it into muktzah machmas isur, because there are many things you could do with musical instruments. But since it's designated primarily for music, which is prohibited on Shabbos, it might become muktzah machmas isur. Yeah.
Sort of more similar to the Mishnah. The nair had been blown out by itself by the wind.
So that's
shemen still remained moving.
Yeah, that's another principle. That's called migudis katsoy ben ashmoshes is katsoy ben yoma, which means that if something is muktzah when you go into Shabbos, it remains muktzah the entire Shabbos. Again, Rabosa, we're going to be spending tons of time on that principle and see how it operates. So as I say, muktzah, you could write a whole mesechta just on muktzah. My heart goes out for me for the members of our Kollel who have to be tested in Hilchos Shabbos, because one of the prime areas that they have to be tested on are the laws of muktzah, and literally it's a year's work just to work through muktzah and figure out how it operates. And as I said, the classical case of muktzah is Eitzim Vavonim. You'll get used to me talking about that, and then from there it branches out, and it's like this amoeba that grows and grows and grows. And there's so many different subcategories and extensions of muktzah. Now, the one that we're studying is sort of like bottom on the list. It's almost the most far-removed kind of muktzah that you could ever imagine. And that's only, by the way, according to Rashi's first shot. In Rashi's second shot, we're not dealing with muktzah at all. And we're going to just see the inami is in just a minute. But first, Kasavar, in the first opinion, Rashi says, Ein kli nital b'shavis ela l'tzorech dovra nital. So here's an extension of muktzah. We're saying that something that's, again, the kli that you're moving now to place underneath the oil, is it muktzah or is it not muktzah? I hope you don't fall into a trap here. It's not muktzah. You could take that kli and move it around from now until Motzei Shabbos. You could put it on your table, eat from it. You can do a lot of things with us. In general, muktzah is something that's exclusively prohibited to the exclusion of everything. And there's no way you can move muktzah on Shabbos. That's why this extension of muktzah is not really muktzah. Because the object that you want to move to catch the oil is not muktzah. And it remains not muktzah. But here we have what I call a specified muktzah, meaning you cannot move something for the sake of muktzah. And that's an extension of Muktzah. Yeah, Don?
You're not lifting the...
Yeah, I was going to say...
You're not lifting the nair.
Yeah, the nair remains where it is.
You're just putting it down for the oil dripping.
To drip into the oil. Okay. So you're not moving the Muktzah.
Okay.
You're only moving the Kli, and you and I would say, why can't you move the Kli?
Is this not Gezer to Gezer? Muktzah is always only a Durabanim. So this is a Durban, unless you come to the Durban.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that, Joel. Everything is going to come in its time. You know, Joel is pointing out that this seems like we're going a little bit too far over here, because the original here is Shemen, and that's not prohibited. The Torah never says on Shabbos that you can't move Shemen, even though it's Muktzah Machmas Isur, and yet the Rabbanan instituted an Gzeira. Now we're going even a step further. We're saying that the second Kli can't be moved for the sake of Muktzah. Isn't that exeril exeril? Let's take a look at Rashi's Inami. Maybe you'll be happier with that. I don't know. Kasavar osur levatel kli mehechano. So you want to underline those four words? That's the subject of Ashia today. That's the title of Ashia. Osur levatel kli mehechano. Very difficult to translate these words, because there are two words here that really require profound analysis. Okay, we'll start with the easy of the two, and that's called Mehechano. Now, the opposite of Muktzah, and you have to write this down because it's going to come up 1,000 times till it's coming out of your ears, is Hachana. Hachana means something that's prepared for Shabbos. Now, let me ask you a question, and I'm assuming everyone in this room is going to answer yes to this question. Okay, I hope so.
A little pressure.
Do you, okay, this question is addressed to everyone here, you know, all six of us. Do you, on Erev Shabbos, walk around your house and do what's called a Maisa Hachana, an act of preparation in which you designate, these are the silverware, you know, that I'm going to use, these are the bowls I'm going to use, this is the cholent pot I'm going to use, these are the begadim, the clothes that I'm going to wear on Shabbos. Can everyone answer yes to that question? How many people can answer yes to that question? I don't hear too many people. Well, we have a unanimous no over here. Now, theoretically, in the conceptual world, that's what we should be doing. In fact, there's a Rashi on Beitza that seems to imply that we have to do this. An active hachana. Because everything is assumed guilty until innocent. Everything is considered muktzah until you designate it as hachana, as muchan. But for some reason, which is going to be one of the most difficult questions in the laws of muktzah, we don't have to actively prepare something. And this is called, in the language of the poskim, hachana me'elav. Again, if I had a blackboard, I would write it. I'll just dictate it to you. Hachon is hey chaf nun hey me'elav. Me'elav means mem aleph yud lamed yud vav. Some people drop the first yud, but me'elav. Me'elav means automatically on its own.
Mem aleph.
Mem aleph. Yud lamed yud vav. Me'elav. Have you ever heard that word me'elav? Automatically, but on its own. In other words, innocent until proven guilty. Just the opposite of what we said before. In other words, anything that you, any object that you imagine in the universe is considered mukhan by itself, automatically. It has a function, it has a purpose, it's not eitz and vavonim, it's not stones, and therefore it's mukhan. Unless, for some reason, you designate it for something that makes it muktzah. Like, for example, the case of Shemen. So on Erev Shabbos, I don't have to run around. Oh, just one second. Yechana means preparation, right. Designation for use. What we're saying now, and again, this, as I said, is oversimplifying, is that everything is considered designated for use. I don't have to actively go around on Erev Shabbos, Erev Yontif, and say, you know, these are the clothes I'm going to wear, and this is the food I'm going to eat, and these are the utensils I'm going to put on my table. It's all it's innocent until proven guilty. What's proven guilty? When I take the shemen, I take the oil, and I put it into the nair, and I say, this is going to be lit oil. And we don't mess around with lit oil. You know what I'm saying? Because as soon as you take away some of the oil, what happens is you end up with kibui, with melechas kibui. So that means I designate it for something that's prohibited. I put it out of my use. That removes hachana. Right? It removes hachana. And I'm no longer going to use it for my salad, even though I could use oil for my salad. But I can't touch this oil. And now, Don, give me just a second. Now what we're saying in our Mishnah is that if I were to take a Kli a utensil. This utensil has not been designated for the oil, right? It's not something that I put the shemen into. This is a regular bowl, you know, out of my drawer, out of my closet, out of my cupboard, right? And now I want to put this, I want to place this bowl underneath my shemen. So Rashi says, according to the second pshat, that is called bitul kli mehechano. So let's go backwards. Hechano means it was muhan. I mean, this is a kli out of the cupboard. It's innocent until proven guilty. I could use it to eat my my Kellogg's cornflakes. Okay, we have Harvey here from the Brits, so, you know, Kellogg's is now a British thing. We got a little bit of an America, but it's really an original, you know, like the Balfour Declaration that I spoke about here on Arab on Shabbos. That's an original Your Majesty's Highness and all that stuff.
Kellogg?
Yeah, I think Kellogg's is a British company, no?
Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Really American.
Okay, so we'll have to, Harvey, you won't be insulting me.
Battle Creek, Michigan.
I try to give you, Harvey, a little extra credit here. We'll try to find another British company.
Next door to Detroit.
So yeah, and what do we do now? Well, we take this bowl out of our cupboard, which is Mukhan, even though I didn't actively designate it for my Kellogg cereal, but it's Mukhan Me'elov, if you remember that term. And now, I'm a vato v'hachana. I cancel and I negate the hachana. How could you negate hachana? Hachana is this abstract idea that it's functional, it's omed l'shibush, it's ready for use. The answer is, I put it in a place where it's going to receive what? Mukta. And once it receives mukta, it itself becomes mukta. Now why, when the oil falls into this, you know, bowl, we'll call it my Kellogg's bowl, why does that bowl become mukta? So that's another category of mukta. That's called basis. A very complicated halacha. It will probably take us a month to figure what that out is. But basis means bet samach yud samach. By the way, Don, this was like the worst day not to have access to a whiteboard. But what can I do? Baruch Hashem, we're happy that Shimi Wida, he was very emotional at the bris. I thought maybe it was the first time he made a bris. I mean, this is his fourth child. But the answer is his first three were girls. So this was, in fact, his first bris, and he got very emotional. Beautiful, beautiful simcha. And we're dedicating this year for the health and the greatness, the future greatness of this little Ezra Yosef, who was just named about an hour ago. Zakut and Gadol Yir. So in any event, now what I do is, I put this kli in such a way that the oil which is mukta is going to fall into the kli. The very moment the oil falls into this receptacle, the receptacle itself becomes a basis ledavar asa. Basis means bet samach yud samach. It becomes a base for mukta. And a base for mukta is also mukta, or quasi-mukta, or something. Anyway, whatever it is, it's not mukhan. So I actively took the hachana, and I destroyed it. I undermined and neutralized that hachana. And according to the second pshat in Rashi, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed on Shabbos to take a kli that's mukhan, and make it ois mukhan. It's no longer mukhan. That's called levatel kli mechano. Lahoshiv, to place down a kli, bimakam in a location, shalo yuchal od litlo. Or some say litlo misham, that he won't be able to take it away afterwards. It's sort of like incarcerating the kli, because you're putting it into a jail. You won't be able to move that kli for the rest of Shabbos, because that kli now has oil in it, and it became a basis ledavar asur. Now, what's wrong with taking a kli and locking it up? You know, putting it in a place that I can no longer move it. Why is that terrible? So Rashi says something very vague, and we're going to have to underline this and rack our brains to figure it out. He says, the Havi, this is equivalent to koveil omakom, to setting up a specific place, specifying a location for this utensil, umechabro betit, and it's as if he cemented it down to the ground. And once you cement something to the ground, it's immovable. You make something immovable. V'dami l'malach, and it's similar to a malach. Now, if I asked you, let's say you would take something and attach it with cement to the ground, which malach of the 39 would that belong to?
Bonim.
Exactly, bonim. This would come under malachas bonim. Now, Rashi doesn't spell out which malach it is, But the implication of Rashi is that you're violating the Iser Bona. Okay then?
Question.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about the...
Speak just a drop louder, because you know there's so much noise here. It's hard to hear you.
So when we're talking about the things that are designate that are considered to be not mukser,
yeah,
unless specifically designated, we're talking about ordinary things in the house, such as a kli, because right. otherwise you still got the problem of the stones and everything else.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. If it's not a stone and it's ordinary things that have a function, then it's muhan. It's considered muhan me'elav. You don't have to go around designating it. It's got its own built-in natural hachana, and that's the opposite of muktzah. But if you designate it, and the question is when, but if at some point, let's say on Erev Shabbos, you designate it for Isur, for something that will prohibit you from using it, that makes it into muktzah. And that's the opposite of hachana. Okay then. Yeah.
How would this be different than a tablecloth? I think isn't there a Mishnah and Beya that shells and nuts fall on a tablecloth? You can tilt the table and the stuff.
So you're right. You know that you'd have to know about yontif. You know, there's certain chumers in yontif that don't apply to shabbos. You know, believe it or not, muktzah is more chumer on yontif than is on shabbos. And the question of shells and things like that, whether they have the status of muktzah. That's a sugyan veitza, yeah. But now we're talking about Shabbos, not Yontif, so we don't have that extra chumra. Now, what is the basis for this halacha of mevatel kli mehechano? Rashi says it's kiilu machabro betit. So take a look at Tosfos here, which is published on Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, the top Tosfos, and he quotes a different Rashi than the one we have. And that Rashi is Beperek Basra. Now, if you take a look, there's a little letter there, which I think is a pei. I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, if you look in Mesoras Hashas, that's Daf Kuf Nun Dalin Amud Beis. That's really at the end of Shabbos, page 154. And there Rashi says, Pirush Bekuntres, the Osur Mishum the mitchaze kisoser vekan pirish the choshev kiu mechabro shom bitit. So we want to underline this Tosfos, because Tosfos presents a contradiction, an apparent contradiction between two explanations of Rashi. Why is mevatel kli mehechano, to destroy, undermine the hachon of the kli, why is that prohibited? Here, Rashi says, because it's as if he attached the kli to the ground, cemented it in. Rashi, at the end of Masechta Shabbos, has a different take on it. Mishum de mitchaze kisoser. Now, we have two malachas that are flip sides of each other, amongst the 39. We have bona and we have soser. Bona means building and soser means destroying. So Rashi's saying that to take a kli and make it, and put it in a situation where you won't be able to move it, in other words, when you talk about using a kli, then primarily you talk about moving it. Right? Every kli that you have, you want to put it on the table, you want to put it on your body if it's a beged, you know, and so forth and so on. If you can't move a kli, then it's
useless.
It's useless, right? It's basically useless. In fact, one of the cases that we're going to have of muktzah is when you take a kli and you designate it for a very specific kind of sensitive work. You know, Harvey is a dentist. So Harvey, can you give me an example of a utensil that you would designate for very sensitive kind of work? Well, Joel, you're an ophthalmologist. I mean, you follow what I'm asking?
Right. You wouldn't want to use for weekday activity.
Yeah, what can you give me a name? I just need, you know, just to illustrate this.
Forceps.
Forceps?
With tweezers.
Tweezers. But very expensive tweezers. You know, not the tweezers that you and I buy here, right. And you know, for my wife to tweeze her eyebrows. Right. So you're talking about very sensitive tweezers. Harvey, come on, give me a name of a utensil that you use as a dentist. You know, one of these sensitive things.
Forceps.
You use forceps in dentistry?
Of course. You take teeth out with them.
Oh, with forceps. Okay. So we're stuck with forceps here. I mean, I was hoping to get, you know, to get something like... what about those, you know, those things that they used? What?
The mirror you put in the mouth.
Oh, the mirror. Okay. I don't know. The mirror is probably not so expensive, but I mean something that's really sensitive. If you, it has to be very sharp. You have to. It's got to be precise, and then you don't want to move it around because unless you're working as a dentist. But when you're not working as a dentist, you put it in a place. You sort of lock it up. You don't want the children to get a hold of it and start moving it around. That becomes mukta. What's called. Mukta machmas. Oh, you know what, Don? I'm not even going to say it because you're going to go why.
Yeah, you can say it.
I can say it. Okay. Mukta machmas chisaron kiss.
It costs money.
Correct. It costs money, and if you start playing around with it and moving it from place to place, okay, a camera might be. You know, it's certain cameras today. I mean, everybody and their uncle has a camera built into their phones and everything. But you know, a real sophisticated camera.
You talk about the Miles knife in this sense.
Miles knife, excellent. The ismal of a mile. You don't want to move that around. It's got to be sharp as anything. Or, for example, you could talk about the knife of a shochet. Also, you know, it's got to be very sharp, and it can't be dull, so you don't want to move this thing around. You basically, when it's not in use, you lock it up. That's called machmas chisaron kiss. You don't want it to, you know, to be spoiled, to get dull instead of sharp, and so forth and so on. So what happens over there in the case of chisaron kiss, because you lock it up, you don't have... access to move it around, that's antithetical to a kli. The whole purpose of a kli, the function of a kli, is to be able to move it around for your function, for your purpose. Here you've locked it up, you don't want to use it. And the reason you don't want to use it is because it's a very sensitive kli for a very sensitive operation, and no one go near it, you know. Oh, if you have children or grandchildren around, you know what I mean. You know, you can't leave things around. Before you know it, they're gone, you know. And that's called mukta. So now we have this Rashi, which is not here in Parakira, but Rashi at the very end of Masechta Shabbos, and he says that
Shabbos means Baba Basra.
Oh, Perek Basra the Shabbos, he means.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's the last Perek in Shabbos. If you take, you could fast forward for me if you don't mind, Joel. See if you can find it on Kuf Nun Dalet Amud Beis. See if you can find that Rashi. I have the wrong volume here, so I
looked at it. I can report it looked like from the, you know, all the notes on the side that maybe there's a Girsa problem over there too.
Ah, but do you see the word Soser there? Hopefully,
yeah.
You'll see the word Soser.
The Girsa was maybe it was built. I mean, it was built. Was it building or destroying?
Right. So Tosus has the Girsa in Rashi of Soser, and therefore he presents this problem because Rashi here in Parakira says that by designating this kli to receive mukta, and now you can't move the kli because the mukta goes in, it becomes a basis l'davar asur. In that case, you've prohibited moving the object, and by prohibited moving the object, you violate maleches soser, according to Rashi on Kuf Nun Dalet. Here, Rashi says you violate maleches bona. Now, when I say you violate, that's a little bit of an extreme formulation, and I got a little bit too dramatic, as I tend to do. I get carried away. But really, it's mechze. Do you see the word mechze in Tosfos? Yeah, it looks like. That means, what kind of an issa are we dealing with? A derabana. We're not dealing with the doraisa. This is not the real mekoy meleches soser, but mechze kis soser. There's enough of a similarity, a resemblance to soser, that derabana said you can't do this on Shabbos. Now, what does it mean, soser? You basically took a kli, a utensil, you made it non-functional. Why? Because you put it in a place where it's not going to receive the oil, and you can no longer move it. And if you can't move it anymore, basically say goodbye. It's useless, right? Kiss it goodbye, as we say. It's soser. Soser means you've taken something that has a function and has a purpose, and you make it purposeless. And that Rashi says. Again, not Rashi here, but Rashi there, that it's michze, it looks a little bit like what? Like soser. So I don't know exactly how to reconcile the two Rashis. I'm in good company, because Tosus himself doesn't know how to reconcile these two Rashis. It's either meleches soser or meleches bona.
Don't we, it's soser for the sake of building? Don't, aren't the two linked? You're destroying something because you want to build? Like the two economy.
So that's a complicated issue. Let's go with a simple shot, very simplistic, which is probably not correct, that you need soser al menas livnos, because otherwise it's makalkel. Mm-hmm. You may remember when we discussed
makalkel and
p'turim, right? When we discussed korea, and we discussed ripping something on Shabbos, do you need that the ripping be in order to prepare for sewing, or is it just that you need the ripping for something or other? Like, for example, for the mitzvah of Kriya, and Nebuchadnezzar, if you lost one of your close relatives, as long as it's not makalkil and it has a purpose to it. So let's assume here, moving the kli has a very great purpose for him. He wants to salvage the dripping, you know, the oil that drips out of the nair, and grab onto it and collect it in a kli before it goes to loss. And that's perfectly a meleches tikkun. It's constructive rather than destructive. But nevertheless, in the mice itself, the action itself, by designating for muktza, that makes it into meleches soser, or at least it looks like soser, because you can no longer move the kli, and therefore it loses its function. And that's called soser. Soser is whenever I take something and I demolish it, or I make it useless. Now the truth is, Rabosai, if you would ask me the following question, I could give an answer to this question. Why did Rashi change his mind? Again, I don't know if that's a fair question, but let's assume, for you know, just for the sake of argument, that Rashi originally thought that the issue of bittul kli mehechano is an issue of soser. And later on in his life, you know, when he got 120 pages later in the Masechta Shabbos, he changed his mind and he said, no, scratch soser and put bona in its place. No, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Don's right. I made a mistake. What I meant to say is that Rashi initially, that's here in our perek, he understood his melech as bona. And then at the end of the Masechta, he changed his mind, and instead of bona, he has meleches soser. Yes.
Soser is also in order to build in its place.
So yeah, that's what Ben was pointing out. That has to be creative. But here it's creative. Right? Again, you know, we can't do all of Masechta Shabbos standing on one foot. But let's just assume that if you have a purpose in this demolishing, whatever that purpose might be, that makes it meleches soser, or at least mechzik is soser on a derabbanan level. So here he has a purpose. He's not crazy. He really wants to salvage the oil, and therefore he is mechzik. He looks like he's violating soser. So let me ask the opposite question, maybe. Why did Rashi initially, why was he reserved or inhibited about meleches soser? Okay, so
here it seems more normal. The oil's in the kli.
Yeah.
And then you can't use it anymore, so it's like it's stuck.
Right. We're actually saying it's stuck in one place.
Status,
and that becomes bona.
Yeah. So it's like when you did bona, the previously maybe non-mukta items became part of the wall.
Right, if you make something part of your ground in such a way that you can't move it anymore, then you destroy the kli. Okay, but Rashi says that that's not called destruction of a kli, but rather that's called bona. That's Rashi here. Later on, Rashi changes his mind and he says, no, it's soser. So again, right now we have a contradiction in these two Rashis, and God willing, hopefully tomorrow we'll try to reconcile that.
But why did he change his mind?
Yeah. So I made a decision, a quick decision, Don, that maybe we'll leave it for tomorrow.
We're not old enough yet. Tomorrow will be
right. Tomorrow.
But I'm not here tomorrow.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to get,
that's okay.
I wanted to make sure that you'll listen to the recording at least. Okay. All right. That's a problem, right? So let's get back to the Mishnah. So the Mishnah says, hey, no. Okay, so Rashi, how many interpretations does Rashi offer? Why am I enjoined from putting the kli underneath the oil? For one of two reasons. Either because ein kli nital el tzorech dovra nital, or because it's mevatel kli mehechon. And what we want to analyze now is where Rashi arrived at these two possible interpretations and what the difference might be, la halacha, between these two interpretations. So let's just finish the Mishnah first, because we still have another line in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, v'im nisanua mib'od yom mutar. In other words, we don't force you if you already went ahead and you violated this prohibition and you put the kli exactly where it is. We're not going to say that you have to take it out of there. Okay? Now, you might say that, wait a minute, if we're going to allow him to take it away, maybe he'll do that when it's a little too late. What's the moment that makes it too late?
Come on.
Vanish Moshe?
No, no, the moment that it makes, and again, here's the scenario. I know you'll all get this answer, so I'm not asking for a rocket scientist here. Here's the case. On Erev Shabbos, you lit the candle. On Shabbos, you went ahead without asking the rabbi what to do, and you took a receptacle and placed it underneath the oil. And now the Mishnah says you're allowed to take it back. You know, you're allowed to remove it. What would be the moment after which you would not be allowed to move it? Until what point can you do it? Exactly. Until the first drop fell in. Because once the first drop of oil falls in, then that receptacle becomes already a basis l'dovra asur. However, we're not going to prohibit you and say, well, you know, I'm afraid if I allow you to remove the kli before the oil goes in there, that you're going to go ahead and you're going to mistakenly remove the kli even after the oil goes in. You know, that far we're not going to go.
Maybe that's the difference between the two things in Rashi. If it's usur to pick up a kli for the purpose of stuff that's mukta, so just putting it there was already a form of touching moving mukta. So you shouldn't have done that at all. So the
again, listen, Shmuel, both answers of Rashi are coming to answer the question why you're not allowed to do this. And let's take the second answer. The second answer is that once you put it there and the oil is going to fall in, it now becomes buses, and therefore you mavatel kli mehechano. But now the question is, are you allowed to take the kli, you know, after you made this mistake, you know, you have your Kellogg's and this is the last utensil that you have to eat your food. Can we allow you? So what I'm suggesting is that we can allow you, but it's a little bit tricky. Because we really have to tell you, you know, immediately remove it. Because if you wait, if you dilly-dally, then what's going to happen is some of the oil is going to fall into the receptacle. That's and if we allow you to remove this receptacle, you might be mistaken, you know, and you took your time, and in the meantime, some oil fell in. So the Mishnah says, mutter, that you're allowed to do. You know, it's up until, but not beyond, the point that the first drop of oil fell in, you're allowed to move the clip. Then it says, v'ein ne'osim imenu. And what happens if some oil falls into that kli? Okay? You know, as we've never really discussed the status of the oil, and even if we come to the conclusion that the oil in the original ner is mukta, so that's because you're not allowed to take any oil out of the ner, but now some oil fell into the second kli, and now I would say that that's not mukta. Why? Because there's no longer an Iser Kivui. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's already out of the original nair. It just spilled over. So now I should be allowed to take the oil. It has a purpose. And the answer is, Lefisha Eino Min HaMukhan. This was never prepared when we went into the Shabbos. And this is the principle that you mentioned before, Shmuel, of Midu Skatzoyle Ben HaShmoshos, meaning, there's a critical moment, which is called Ben HaShmoshos. That's the moment we enter into Shabbos. If at that moment it was not Mukhan, then there's no such thing as making it Mukhan on Shabbos. 24-hour unit, indivisible, cannot be broken into its component parts. As far as Mux is concerned, the entire Shabbos is one entity, indivisible. And therefore, if we entered into Shabbos and it was Mukta, because the Shemen was in the Nair, then even if I have a situation where the Shemen fell out of the Nair, it remains Mukta.
What is Mutter? You did it on Friday, it's Mutter. What's Mutter?
Mutter means that on Shabbos, when you inadvertently, let's say you were a shogeg, for example, or let's say you shouldn't have done it, whatever it is. On Shabbos, we're going to allow you to take it back.
La'nicha means to leave it there, no? Rashi says la'nicha. This means to take it.
Im nasnu mi ba'odjom.
Mutter la'nicha sham.
Ah. So Rashi, you're right. Rashi has a different shot. So let's see. So what I interpreted was that you're allowed to take it away. And we're not afraid that some oil fell in. But Dr. Joel points out that Rashi didn't interpret it that way. Rashi says, Mutar. Wait, where is Rashi? La Nicham Sham. Right, you're allowed to leave it there. So let me just see, why is that a chiddush that you're allowed? Chaf Zion, let me just see.
Ain Choshishin.
Ain Choshishin Shem Yavola Taltil. Ah, I see. It's very similar to what I said. In other words, we're afraid that if the oil comes in, then you might be tempted to take it away after the oil came in. So the answer is no. We're allowed to tell him, make sure you take away the kli before the oil comes in, and we're not afraid.
Well, that is what you said the first time, because
I'm saying we don't say to him, make sure to take away the kli, because otherwise the oil is going to fall into the kli, and then you might move the kli around after the oil comes in. Yeah, you're allowed to leave it there. Okay. Omar Av Chizda. Afal Pisha Omru Ein Nostin Kli Tachas Atarnagoles. We have a case of a hen that lays eggs. Now, an egg that's laid on Shabbos is Muktzah. It's actually called Noad. Okay, now you want to take a bowl and place it underneath the hen such that the egg will fall into a bowl, and the bowl is not to protect the egg, because if you don't, the egg will roll around, people will stop. Right, people step on it and they'll ruin it. And therefore, you want to move this kli for the purpose of receiving an egg, lekabel beit sasa, and that's prohibited. Now, up until this point, Rav Chizda is really just reiterating what we know from our Mishnah. Because our Mishnah says you can't move a kli in order to receive the shemen, the oil, because the oil is muktzah. And Rav Chizda is just simply applying this to the case where he moves the kli in order to receive what? The egg, which is muktzah. Ah, but here's the chiddush. Aval kofe oleha kli. But what he's allowed to do to protect the egg from getting ruined, getting smashed, getting broken, is to take a kli and put it on top of the egg. He can't receive the egg, but he could cover the egg. And why? Why is he doing such a thing and covering the egg? Shelo tishavet, to make sure that nobody walks around and kicks the egg and ruins it. Now, l'chora, let's take, if you don't mind moving backwards, because that's where my head is at now, on the second pshat of Rashi, we'll go upwards, from the bottom up. Rashi says that you're not allowed to move a kli for the sake of muktzah. Now, Rav Chizda says you're allowed to move this kli in order to cover up the beitza, where the beitza is muktzah. So this l'chora is going to be a major problem according to the second interpretation of Rashi. Let's see if the first interpretation of Rashi makes a little bit more sense. Rashi says that the problem with moving this kli underneath the oil is that it's going to receive what? It's going to receive the oil. Correct? And we have a rule, says Rashi, that ein kli nital b'shabbos el litzorech dovar anital. Ah! I see. I jumped the gun. Actually, the first pshat in Rashi is a little bit easier. Of course, according to the first pshat of Rashi, this Gemara is problematic. According to the second pshat of Rashi, give me a minute just to work out the mathematics here. According to the second pshat of Rashi, that you're being mevatel kli me'echano. Here, you're not being mevatel kli me'echano by covering over the egg. Why? Because it's not a basis. It's not receiving the egg, it's covering the egg. So if you would receive the egg, that would be exactly identical to the case of receiving the oil. And therefore you would not be permitted to move this receptacle in order to receive the egg, just like you're not allowed to move the receptacle to receive the oil. But if you're taking the receptacle and you're covering the egg, then there's no problem, because the muktzah is not going to enter into the receptacle. It's just going to be protected by the receptacle. And if you're not being mevatel me'echano,
you're not receiving it. You're just leaving it inside.
Right, but if you go back to the first chat in Rashi, that ein kli nital el litzarech dovar anital, well, the egg is not a dovar anital, and therefore how can you move the kli for the purpose of the egg? As we established in the first chat of Rashi, you're not allowed to move a receptacle for the purpose of an object which is in itself muktzah. So this is going to be a problem. So let's see. Omar Rabba, my time with Rav Chizda. How do we justify Rav Chizda's distinction between putting the kli underneath the hen, underneath the egg, and covering the egg? Putting it underneath and receiving the egg is prohibited, according to Rav Chizda, but covering the egg is permissible. The answer is, Kosova, Rav Chizda holds, Tarnagoles asuya lahatil beitzosa bi'ashpa. V'eina asuya lahatil beitzosa b'mokom midrom. Okay, we'll get back to this in just a minute. But the punchline is coming up now. The hatsola mitsuya hitiru, hatsola she'eina mitsuya lo hitiru. So what he's saying is the following, that ein achinami, in both these cases, it should be prohibited. Whether or not you receive, you're putting the bowl in such a place that you receive the egg, or you're using the bowl to cover the egg, in both cases, you have a problem because ein kli nitol el litzorach hanitol. Dovra nitol. However, hitiru, what does the word hitiru mean?
He allowed it.
Means there's a pressing need to allow it. Now, this is fascinating because what we have to analyze here is within the matrix, the constellation of Muktzah, when do we say that for the sake of X, Y, or Z, we're going to allow moving Muktzah? I'm going to assume that there's no heter for Muktzah other than, you know, pikuach nefesh, if somebody's life is at stake. But the Gemara wants to say that this principle that we don't permit Muktzah has an exception. And the exception to that rule is when you're moving something which in and of itself is not Muktzah for the sake of something which is Muktzah, and in this case you're doing so in order to protect that object, then we're going to allow it. We're going to allow you to move an object which is not Muktzah for the sake of an object that is Muktzah in order to save that object so it doesn't get destroyed. And the overriding reason, the push here, is Hatzolah. Hatzolah means to save the object. In other words, the halacha has a great deal of compassion for ownership, for, you know, something that's going to get ruined and it's going to get lost. You know, imagine this guy makes his his living selling eggs, or alternatively, he needs the egg for his family to feed them. So all of a sudden, we become compassionate. Does this mean that we're going to just simply waive W-A-I-V-E, right? Waive the laws of Muktzah, the prohibition of Muktzah for the sake of Hatzolah? No. What it means is that in this particular extension, as we call it, of Muktzah, where you're not really moving Muktzah, you're moving something that's a Dovra Nital. But we said you can't move it for the sake of a Dovra Sheino Nital, then we're going to allow it for the sake of Hatzolah. Oh, here's where Rav Chisda comes along, and he says there are two types of Hatzolah. There's what's called Hatzolah Mitsuya, and there's Hatzolah She'ena Mitsuya. There's Hatzolah, which is something that we have to be very concerned about, meaning if you don't take precautions, there's a very good probability that you're going to lose the object. And then there's a case which is, you know, it's far out. You know, there is a possibility you might lose the object, but it's not probable. That's called Eino Mitsuya. And the Gemara says the following, that Tarnagoles Asuya Lahatil Beit Sosa Bi Ashpa. Ashpa is a place where it's very common for an egg to be laid, and it's very common for the egg, if you don't protect it, to be lost, to be destroyed, to be stepped on or kicked.
It's a garbage heap, no?
And in such a case, it's called Mitsuya. That's the word that you want to use. V'ena asuya lahatil beitzasa v'mako midron. But here's a case where we don't anticipate that the hen is going to lay its egg. It's called a mako midron. We'll have to see exactly what mako midron is. But the main point is, as I said before, v'hatzola mitsuya. Now, if you have an egg in an ashpa place, in that situation, that's mitsuya. What does mitsuya mean?
Commonplace.
Hitiru. The Chachom will allow you to move a kli even for the purpose of muktzah, in order to protect that muktzah from going down the drain, from getting destroyed. That's called Hatzola Mitsuya. But Hatzola She'ena Mitsuya, that's the case where the egg was laid bimadron, and that's unusual. There we don't anticipate that something is going to get lost, and therefore if it's not Mitsuya, Lohi Tiru. They weren't Matir. Now, before we get into the distinction between Ashpo, which is called Mitsuya, and Midron, which is called Eina Mitsuya, I just want to point out that based on this distinction, we have to go back to our Mishnah. And we're going to have to assume that the oil that's dripping out of the Nair is what? Is it Mitsuya or Eina Mitsuya? No, you're going to have to assume it's Eina Mitsuya. Because if it's Mitsuya, Joel, then why did the Mishnah prohibit putting the Kli in order to receive the shemen? If shemen is also very precarious, which you and I think would have agreed,
we're not saving it, we're making this thing a bus. It's obviously going to be.
No, what I'm saying is that if he doesn't put the kli there, the shemen is going to fall on the ground. It's lost.
Oh, we're trying to save the Shemin.
That's what he's... Wait, let's go back to square one. What is our Mishnah about? On a psychological level, not on a halachic level. Our Mishnah is all about saving oil. Uh-huh. Why? Because if oil drips and you haven't put a receptacle under the dripping oil, the oil is gone. Okay. Oil is an expensive commodity. Let's assume.
Malfunction, isn't it? It's really not supposed to leak.
Okay, so maybe that's the answer to my question. Shmuel's already giving, he's always a step ahead of me. I just wanted to ask the question, and Shmuel's going to answer the question. But my question is, logically, from the sugya here of Rabba, we have to derive mathematically a certain conclusion about the Shemin case in our Mishnah, because the Mishnah prohibits taking a receptacle and placing it underneath the Shemin to save the Shemin. And we just said we're allowed to do it for the sake of saving, but only if it's what? Hatzola Mitsuya. Apparently, the Shemin case is like the Majon case, which is Hatzola She'ena Mitsuya. Okay? And Shmuel fits in the missing piece of the puzzle. Why is it Eina Mitsuya? Why did you light the candle in such a way where it's tipping over and the nair is dripping out? You know, this was a fashla, as we call it. That's an Arabic word. No, so you didn't do it the right way. Had you been very careful about it, it would have been equally balanced. Then there's no reason to anticipate that the oil is going to be lost. But, oh no, I look at the nair and I see, wait a minute, you know, it's off balance, it's not, it's not balanced well, and therefore I'm going to lose my oil. Can I move a kli in order to save my oil? So the answer is no. Why, says Rabba? Because Tzol She'ena Mitsuya. It's not something that we anticipated in all likelihood would happen. But in the case of an egg, we know that the egg is going to be very precarious. And therefore, again, you could always ask me, well, why didn't he put the kli there on Erev Shabbos? You know, that if he was a smarty, Ezu Chacham Aros HaNolad, literally Nolad here in this case, right? He should have put the kli there on Erev Shabbos. Okay, he didn't do so. So we're going to look aside. We're going to permit something which normally would be prohibited for the sake of Hatzola Mitsuya, because the egg is in a very precarious situation. When is it considered Hatzola She'ena Mitsuya? That's called Midron. So what does Midron mean?
Slope.
A slope, yeah. What does this mean over here? Why is the slope Eina Matsui?
Well, so the egg will get away.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's what I wanted to prepare before the Shia, but I couldn't get access to the Svarim over here because of the Bris Baruch Hashem. So Don, can you tell me why Midron is Eina Matsui? He must have a footnote over there. Shmuel, you want to help out Don there, because two are better than one here in this case.
Hey, hang on, more challenge. Hang on.
It's a slope, basically.
Right. So, how do you picture? You know, I'm just trying to, you know,
What's the question of the word? An incline, I think.
An incline. Yeah. So, why is that considered Hatzola She'ena Mitsuya?
Because you can't normally stop things falling off a slope.
It's a very long footnote.
Well, see if you can give it to me, and I was going to do this work before, but you know, circumstances beyond my control prevented me from doing so. Do you happen to remember what number it is by any chance?
13, 14.
Yeah. Okay.
Circumcisions beyond.
He says the following. He says that. He says the following. That Rav Chisda forbids placing a non-muktzah vessel under a hen to receive its muktzah egg. Because, again, this involves moving a vessel for the sake of muktzah, and that we're not allowed to do. Why is it permitted to cover the egg, right, to cover the egg? And the answer is, he says, because this is commonplace. Okay, so far so good. And the rabbis relaxed the prohibition, that's called heter, against moving a non-mukta item for the sake of mukta, in a case of a commonplace hatzola. Hatzola means to save the object from getting lost. By contrast, the likelihood that a hen will lay its egg on an incline is remote. And the rabbis did not feel a need to relax their prohibition for such a rare case that is not likely to occur. Wait, just give me a minute, Rabosei. So again, if the egg is laid on a slope, and now what Now, again, all we're trying to do is cover the egg. Just one second. What does he want to do? He wants to cover the egg, so we're not going to allow him. Just one second. In a case of that. Oh, once it lands. Once. Oh, I see. Once it lands. Oh, I here. You'll tell me if I'm wrong, but I think what's being said is the following: that if the egg falls on a vertical, up and down, you know, straight line, it's not gonna break. I don't know why. Maybe there's some soft.
Horizontal surface.
No, it's an incline.
Stay there. This is an incline.
No. What I'm saying is that when the egg comes down, there's no need to receive the egg. Leave the egg, and it'll be fine. I don't know why that's so. Maybe because it's a soft ground. Maybe it's on grass. I don't know. Maybe because she sits on the ground itself. I don't know.
It's usually straw.
And straw.
It's, and it's very close to where she's sitting. So.
She's sitting close to the ground. Close to the straw. Fine. But the moment that she lifts herself up, the egg is exposed. Now people walking by could crush the egg. Again, let's just assume. It's less important. The details are really less important to me than the concepts here. But let's assume. Okay. So to allow him to cover the egg, that's already matzli. Now, there is one case in which you've got to catch the egg as it falls. And that's where the hen lays its egg on an incline. It's no longer a vertical line. Again, as you point out, Don, the vertical line may be very minimal because the egg sits on the ground. So there may be no line at all, for that matter. But in a case of a madron, where the ground below the hen is slopes, as Harvey says very well, there the very process until the egg finally finds its resting place is dangerous for the egg. It's going to bump around, it might hit some barriers on the way, and therefore he wants to catch the egg. He wants to catch the egg as it's going down. That he's not allowed to do. Because that's already an unusual set of circumstances. What's commonplace is that after the egg finds its resting place on the ground, then it's in a very dangerous situation. That's called Hezeko Matsui, or Hatsola Mitsuya. And for that, we're going to allow him to use a kli to cover up over that. Again, this whole sugya makes so much more sense according to Rashi's second pshat. That we're not dealing with the prohibition of ein kli nital el davar nital with a special heter litzorach hatzola, and it has to be hatzola mitzuya, but simply asul levatel kli meichana. And asul levatel kli meichana is only when the muktzah will go into the kli. But here, by covering over the egg, the muktzah is not going into the kli, and he could simply remove the covering, the receptacle that he used to cover the egg at any point. So therefore, he wasn't levatel kli meichana. So, Rabosai, for tomorrow, I'm just pointing out that there are two major questions that we want to analyze. One is the two Rashis about Bittul Kli Mehechano. Rashi here on our Mishnah assumes that Bittul Kli Mehechano is called Meleches Soser, and Rashi later on, excuse me, Rashi here in Perek Kira in our Mishnah seems to assume that Levatel Kli Mehechano is Meleches Bone, and Rashi at the end of the Masechta assumes that Levatel Kli Mehechano is Meleches Soser. That's question number one. Question number two, according to what we saw here in the Sugya of Rabbah, who's interpreting Rav Chisda, we have to understand why are we going to be Mekil and be Matir here for the sake of Hatzola Mitsuya, but not for the sake of Hatzola She'ena Mitsuya. Let's just add, another few lines, because this is a technical part that, I'm going to do something that's illegal, but we'll do it anyway. Let's just fast forward to Rav Yosef. Okay, so we're on Daf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph now, and you're counting down, I would say about 8 lines down for the top, Rav Yosef Omar. You have such a thing?
6 lines.
And what you have to do during Chavrusa time today is fill in the missing blanks here. In other words, the Gemara that I skipped. So what does Rav Yosef say? Hainu time of the Rav Chisda. I'm going to fill in a little extra of my own here, just for drama purposes. And I'm going to say the following. Rav Yosef's turning to Rabbah, and he's saying, you misunderstood Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda was not based on Ein Kli Nital, Elo L'Dovra Nital. Because if that would be the case, who says that we're going to be mocked for the sake of Hatzola? but rather Rav Chisda is based on a different logic, and that is mishum dekama vatel kli mehechano. This is Rashi's second interpretation. So it's very cool what Rashi did on the Mishnah to justify why you're not allowed to put the utensil under the oil that's dripping. Is Rashi gave me number one Rabba's understanding and number two Rav Yosef's understanding. Rabba says ain kli nital el davar nital. Rav Yosef says also levatel kli mehechano. And therefore says Rav Yosef, everything fits in beautifully, because what is Rav Chisda saying? That if you put the kli underneath the oil, or in the case of the egg, if you put it underneath the egg, the oil is muktzah, the egg is muktzah. Now the kli becomes basis, and therefore it's batel mihechano. It's no longer mukhan, it's now muktzah. But if you take the kli and you put it on top of the egg, that's okay. Why? Because that's not mevatel kli mehechano. You move the kli for the sake of a davresheno nitel for muktzah. That doesn't bother Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef never recognized that principle that you're not allowed to move a kli unless it's for the purpose of something that itself is movable. But rather, according to Rav Yosef, the whole business here is reduced to one and only one issue, and that's called bitel kli mehechano. So if you put the kli in a way that now the muktzah is going to come into the kli, that you're not allowed to do. Why aren't you allowed to do it? That's a steer in Rashi, whether it's Mishum Aleches Bonel, Mishum Aleches Soser, whatever it might be. But that's prohibited, to be Mavatel Kli Mehechon. Okay, then do we have the structure? Okay, Donna, you're on now, but I just want to say that what I'm happy about is that, you know, when you start a new sugya, the main thing is to get the framework, the structure of the sugya. The structure of the sugya is that when the Mishnah prohibits you from placing a receptacle under the oil that's dripping, there are two ways of understanding that. And according to the second way of understanding, we're going to allow you to move a kli in such a way that it doesn't become batel mehechano because it's not receiving the muktzah. And why are you not allowed to put the kli in such a way that it'll receive the muktzah? Rashi offers two different answers to that question. So that's the framework, the structure of the suit.
So possibly we're going to cover it, but presumably if you're putting it on top of it and it's not then considered to be muktzah itself, then you can lift it again.
Correct. It's not a basis. Because a basis only means when the muktzah goes into the kli, and now the kli is receiving the muktzah. But to take the kli and cover muktzah, that's okay. You can move the kli back and forth as many times as
you
want.
It would make no difference if the land is planted or it's flat.
Yeah, this whole distinction here about mitsuya, hatsola this, hatsola that, is all irrelevant. And it's, you know, Rav Yosef is really so much smoother, you know, it's smooth sailing in terms of understanding Rav Chisda's distinction. It's almost as if Rav Yosef's understanding comes out of the pages of Rav Chisda's words, you know, out of his mouth, because Rav Chisda is saying, well, don't put the kli in such a way that it'll receive the muktzah, but I couldn't care less if you cover the muktzah. Rabbah has to say, well, ain't kli nital and tzorach nital, has to be some sort of heter. You know, we're worried, you know, chaser achmona al mamona shel Yisrael. You know, the Torah is compassionate about losing an egg. You know, you don't want to crack an egg, you know, lose the egg. But Rav Yosef is going very smooth over here. Rav Yosef is saying that by covering the egg, you're not making the kli itself into muktzah. It's not a basis. And you can remove the kli whenever you feel, you know, free enterprise, whenever you feel like doing so. And therefore, there's no violation of ein mevatlim kli mehechon. Okay, then, so that's where we're going to hold it for today. And I always like to announce my Chumash class, which in Mitzvah Shem will take place at 11 o'clock. Hopefully we'll be able to go back into the room there. We'll see if they will re-invite us there, at least by 11.